This week on the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine podcast.
Her blood gas result also reported out an elevated sulfhemoglobin level. Much to the team's surprise, prior to her colonoscopy, her GI pathogen panel returned positive for Yersinia enterocolitica.
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance their educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by the podcast is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid abusive opinion, but all opinions represented are our own and are not representative of an employer. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome
to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Welcome back to Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast. So since our last recording, we both got our COVID vaccinations.
We have, finally.
It's been a really exciting time getting to see all the people come in to get their COVID vaccines. I've seen a few people leaving and just the excitement and joy of the safety of getting the vaccine.
Even when I was getting mine, the nurse who was doing it said that it took her a couple days to stop crying with joy every time she gave a vaccine.
That's awesome. There's definitely a lot of hope that things are going to continue to improve. We have had some declining cases and we hope that it continues in that trend.
But thankfully, we're not talking about COVID today.
That's right. We've got Dr. Funky here to do a few more cases of Vanderbilt Morning Report.
Hey, everyone. I am super pumped to be back with you all. And I agree with you, Alex. I actually recently tweeted that my favorite thing to do lately is to give people directions to their COVID vaccine because people look so excited and then I get really excited for them. And I think it's super fun.
Speaking of fun, I hear you have some fun cases for us to work through today.
Oh, I do. We are going all the way back to step one studying.
Did you say fun?
And the hemoglobin oxygen dissociation curve.
All right, well, let's jump into it. What's our first case?
First case is a patient with a metastatic GYN cancer with bladder invasion who came from home with increasing shortness of breath over the course of about a week. When she got here, she was cyanotic, sitting in the 80s on a non-rebreather, but had a blood gas that showed a pH of 7.39, CO2 of 40, and a PaO2 of 500. Well, luckily for the team, her blood gas result also reported out an elevated sulfhemoglobin level, making this a case of sulfhemoglobinemia. Collateral history revealed a recent increase in her pyridium dosing to treat her bladder spasms, which was the likely culprit.
No. Yeah, so we're definitely going to have to dive into this a little bit further. Those were a lot of words that I didn't understand.
Yeah, if you're like the resident on the team that was taking care of her, you maybe also don't know what sulfhemoglobin is. It's pretty rare and fortunately is reported out on blood gas results. We're not going to talk a ton about sulfhemoglobinemia because it is pretty rare, but we are going to talk more about dyshemoglobinemias in general.
Just start us off, what is a dyshemoglobinemia in general?
So there are three pathologic forms of hemoglobin we're going to talk about today. So dyshemoglobin is just a hemoglobin molecule that's been altered and is no longer functioning the way it normally would. The three pathologic forms of hemoglobin we're going to talk about today are methemoglobinemia, caused by abnormal hemoglobin oxidation, carboxyhemoglobinemia, caused by carbon monoxide binding to hemoglobin, and finally, sulfhemoglobinemia, caused by the binding of sulfur to hemoglobin.
I know you mentioned step one. Can you give us a little refresher about how all of this works?
I'm happy to. First, let's start with a basic review of the physiology of hemoglobin and why this matters. You may recall that hemoglobin has a variable affinity for oxygen, and this affinity is dependent on a number of factors, most notably the partial pressure of oxygen and carbon dioxide, as well as pH. When your red blood cells, and the hemoglobin they contain, pass by alveoli in the lungs, the relatively high oxygen and low carbon dioxide concentrations in the lungs are associated with increased affinity, leading to hemoglobin binding oxygen, taking up oxygen from the alveoli, and thus the formation of oxyhemoglobin, which will then be delivered to the tissues. Compare this to the microvasculature in our tissues, which are metabolically active and have an environment that's relatively low in oxygen, high in carbon dioxide, thus promoting oxyhemoglobin dissociation and oxygen release to our tissue cells. The last point I'm going to make before diving into the dyshemoglobinemias more specifically is that recall that the adult hemoglobin molecule has four polypeptide chains, and each contains a heme group at the center of which is an atom of iron in the ferrous, that's the Fe2+, aka the unbound state. And these iron atoms are the site of oxygen binding. This is going to be important in just a minute.
I'm assuming that's where everything goes wrong.
More or less. First up, we're going to talk about carboxyhemoglobin. hemoglobinemia, aka carbon monoxide poisoning. This should be suspected in patients with a known exposure, such as a house fire or exposure to motor vehicle exhaust, or in chronic heavy smokers.
Blake, walk us through how carbon monoxide poisoning develops.
So a small amount of carboxyhemoglobin is produced by the body every day. And under certain conditions, such as hemolysis, increased endogenous production can occur, though it's rare for levels to reach clinical significance. Still, the more common cause of carboxyhemoglobinemia is via breathing polluted air. Carbon monoxide has a high affinity for heme, binding at the same site as oxygen binds at greater than 200 times the affinity, and thus producing carboxyhemoglobin. To put it simply, carbon monoxide reduces the oxygen-carrying capacity of hemoglobin, and it does so in a dose-dependent manner. It also decreases the affinity for oxygen at the remaining heme sites.
So in carboxyhemoglobinemia, is carbon monoxide just binding all of the sites and not leaving any sites for oxygen to bind because it has a higher affinity?
Well, carbon monoxide does do a pretty good job of kicking oxygen off of sites, but it also decreases the affinity for oxygen at the remaining heme sites, even ones that it's not directly bound to. If you think back to your step one diagrams, it displaces the hemoglobin-oxygen dissociation curve to the left and therefore decreases the release of oxygen at tissues, which is ultimately what leads to the tissue hypoxia.
So even the oxygen that's able to bind to heme isn't able to release in the tissue.
Correct.
In someone where we suspect carboxyhemoglobinemia, what should we look for on physical exam or in our labs?
Great question. Patients can present with a constellation of symptoms depending on the severity of their exposure. The most common symptoms are headache, dizziness, confusion, nausea, and vomiting, which can progress to altered mental status, coma, seizures. It's important to have a high index of suspicion because the consequences can be so devastating, particularly in patients who are found down with unclear clinical history.
I think the thing that confuses me the most about this hemoglobinemia is discerning between the differences. So what are the key points of a carboxyhemoglobinemia that differentiate it from methemoglobinemia or other dyshemoglobinemias?
First of all, the clinical picture is a little different for carbon monoxide poisonings, as we already mentioned. But additionally, some of the other diagnostic clues that you're going to use vary depending on the underlying cause. So in these cases, it's important to take a close look at the peripheral pulse ox saturation, as well as values obtained on an ABG. For carboxyhemoglobinemia in particular, carboxyhemoglobin absorbs at approximately the same wavelength of light as oxyhemoglobin. So that's normal oxygenated hemoglobin. And so poisoning can actually result in a falsely normal pulse oximetry value that does not reflect the underlying tissue hypoxia. An arterial oxygen saturation, like obtained from an ABG, tends to be normal because carbon monoxide does not affect the amount of oxygen dissolved in the blood, but rather reduces the concentration of hemoglobin-bound oxygen. You may have also heard that these patients will exhibit a classic cherry red appearance, although this is certainly not required.
If all of these tests are falsely normal, how do we make the diagnosis?
We'll talk a little bit at the end about co-oximetry, but that's the key, measuring a carboxyhemoglobin level.
If we do diagnose carboxyhemoglobinemia, how do we treat it?
Treatment is administration of 100% oxygen in mild to moderate cases, or in severe cases, hyperbaric oxygen, because oxygen therapy reduces the half-life of carboxyhemoglobin. According to my reading, carboxyhemoglobin has a half-life of about 4 hours when breathing room air. This is reduced to just 90 minutes with 100% supplemental oxygen and less than 30 minutes if hyperbaric oxygen is used. Pretty impressive.
I think the other dyshemoglobinemia we think about a lot is methemoglobinemia. What are the differences? Help us compare the two.
First of all, Alex, I'm glad to hear that you're thinking about dyshemoglobinemias a lot.
All the time.
I love it.
Me up at night.
That's what I dream about.
I think I have dreamed about it as well in preparing for this podcast. So unlike carboxyhemoglobinemia, methemoglobinemia can present with low pulse oximetry readings, cyanosis, but similarly will have normal PaO2 readings on the ABG.
Okay, so far I'm hearing that a big difference will be your pulse ox won't lie to you in methemoglobinemia.
I wish that were the case, but unfortunately it can. With rising methemoglobin levels, peripheral pulse oximetry saturations will appear to fall, but at higher levels, around 30 to 35%, met hemoglobin levels, the pulse ox saturation will reach a nadir around 85% and won't really go below that. So it may still actually overestimate tissue oxygenation in really severe intoxications.
So once again, we really can't trust the pulse ox here.
Never right? trust a pulse ox. I never thought I would say that as a future pulmonologist, but in this case, it's true.
Blake, remind us of what are the most common causes of methemoglobinemia?
It turns out there are some rare inherited causes of methemoglobinemia, but far more common in the cases that we'll encounter in the hospital are due to acquired methemoglobinemia, usually following drug exposure. Some of the common offending drugs that we think of include dapsone, raspuricase, and nitroglycerin.
So I know we went through why carboxyhemoglobin causes problems. How does methemoglobin cause problems?
Methemoglobinemia occurs when the ferrous iron, that 2+ that we talked about within the hemoglobin molecule, undergoes increased oxidation to the ferric form, the 3+ form of iron, at a rate that can't be counteracted by our normal backup system of reducing enzymes. This oxidation of iron prevents oxygen binding, reducing oxygen carrying capacity at that particular heme site, and also increases the oxygen affinity at the remaining normal heme sites, which at first would sound like a good thing, increased oxygen uptake.
Sure. Yeah.
However, the increased affinity is abnormal and makes it so that it's difficult for oxygen to be released at the tissues when you want it to be.
So you have decreased carrying capacity of oxygen and also decreased delivery of oxygen to the tissues.
Yes, exactly. This is what results in tissue hypoxia.
My mnemonic when studying for step one was MET and meth for methylene blue. So you just pump these people up with methylene blue, right? Just like crazy high doses.
Not quite. It turns out, which I did not know until I was preparing for this podcast, that at low doses, methylene blue does treat methemoglobinemia by hastening the conversion from the ferric form back to the ferrous form of hemoglobin, the form that's able to readily accept oxygen. At high doses, it actually has the opposite effect and converts iron from the ferrous form back to the ferric form and actually forms methemoglobin.
So that just leaves sulfhemoglobinemia. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sulfhemoglobinemia is pretty rare. There seem to be many less articles about sulfhemoglobinemia than the other two I talked about. But what I was able to gather is that similar to methemoglobinemia, patients can present with cyanosis, low pulse oxygen saturations, and a normal arterial oxygen saturation on ABG. However, unlike methemoglobinemia, sulfhemoglobin is produced by the oxidation of the iron in the hemoglobin, again, going from that ferrous Fe2+ state to the ferric Fe3+ state by certain drugs and chemicals containing sulfur. Unlike the other two dyshemoglobinemias we talked about, the binding of sulfur to the hemoglobin porphyrin ring is irreversible, so sulfhemoglobin lasts for the lifetime of the erythrocyte.
Is there anything that we can do to shorten that, or?
There's not great data, but there does not seem to be an obvious treatment. The offending medications should be elucidated and stopped, and severe cases may require exchange transfusion to replace the abnormal erythrocytes with normal functioning erythrocytes.
What medications should we be worried about?
As I said, it's not very common, but some offending medications could be dapsone, sulfonamides, metoclopramide, and nitrates. And apparently pyridium, although it's not commonly reported in the literature.
Blake, we have covered a lot of different information here. Can you sort of wrap it up into a few take-home points for our listeners?
So I think the key to differentiating these is looking at the patient's clinical picture in addition to some readily available objective findings. So recall that we said with carboxyhemoglobinemia, these patients are going to present with a different constellation of symptoms from the other two we talked about. They may have headaches, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, which progresses to altered mental status and potentially seizures at really high exposures. People who have found down in house fires, for example, or have had prolonged exposure to car exhaust. These patients can present with a normal pulse ox saturation, falsely normal, and a normal, truly normal, arterial oxygen saturation. Treatment is 100% oxygen or hyperbaric oxygen, and diagnosis can be confirmed with co-oximetry on a whole blood sample. This is a different clinical picture from methemoglobinemia, which will often present with cyanosis and dyspnea on exertion or at rest with really high levels. With severe cases, the pulse ox saturation will plateau at about 85%. That's sort of a board question, very characteristic. And they will also have a normal PaO2 on the ABG, again, because it's not affecting the amount of oxygen dissolved in the blood. Treatment is methylene blue and discontinuation of offending medications. This is similar to sulfhemoglobinemia, which also can present with a low pulse ox saturation, cyanosis, and they will also have a normal PaO2. It's also often drug-induced, so you should be sure to explore the medication list, stop any offending medications, and in severe cases may require exchange transfusion because unlike the other two, this is an irreversible dyshemoglobinemia. Patients with carboxyhemoglobinemia may have a cherry red blood sample and may themselves appear to be flushed. Patients with methemoglobinemia might have a chocolate brown blood sample, even on an ABG. And the most fun one is sulfhemoglobinemia, which can cause a bright green blood sample.
Well, now I'll know what to think about if an ABG looks green. Blake, that was a ton of great information, but I have to say my mind is spinning just a little bit thinking about hemoglobin, ferrous, ferric, all of that. Can we go to something a little more up my alley, maybe something ID?
I've got just the case for you, Casey. We've got a patient presenting with 3 weeks of cramping abdominal pain, worse in the right lower quadrant, coming in with a mild leukocytosis, elevated inflammatory markers, and a CT abdomen pelvis that showed thickening of the terminal ileum, suggestive of terminal ileitis. Now, if you're like me, the first time I saw a CT scan report that called a diagnosis of terminal ileitis, you might be thinking, okay, great, that's a diagnosis, but what caused it? Does this mean the patient has Crohn's disease? That seems to be an association that I have, but should I treat them for an infectious cause? As we'll discuss in a moment, the differential is broad, but can usually be narrowed down into a few most likely causes based on a patient's risk factors, demographics, and clinical picture. For this particular patient, she was treated empirically with ciprofloxacin and metronidazole for a possible infectious cause, but there is quite a bit of concern for Crohn's disease still, and so she was planned for colonoscopy that admission. Much to the team's surprise, prior to her colonoscopy, her GI pathogen panel returned positive for Yersinia enterocolitica, the old pseudoappendicitis, an elusive diagnosis for me. Ever since seeing the sketchy micro video, I've been longing to make a diagnosis of Yersinia, but alas, I have not.
So I understand that kind of what you want to talk to us about, though, is some of the mimickers of Crohn's disease and things that cause terminal ileitis. What's on that list?
Well, as the name implies, terminal ileitis refers to inflammation of the terminal portion of the ileum that's often accompanied by acute right lower quadrant pain plus or minus diarrhea. The most common cause of terminal ileitis is inflammatory bowel disease, specifically Crohn's disease. However, there are other etiologies that should be considered. Ulcerative colitis can cause something called backwash ileitis due to impaired ileocecal valve function in severe ulcerative colitis. This causes backflow of colonic content and thus inflammation specifically at the site of the terminal ileum. Infectious causes include Yersinia, as we already mentioned, which can cause a pseudoappendicitis syndrome, which we'll talk about a little bit more later. Intestinal TB seems to have a predilection for the ileocecal area, which per my reading seems to be due to a high density of lymphoid aggregates in that area, neutral pH, as well as physiologic stasis. Other infectious causes include salmonella, histoplasmosis, CMV, though these are more common in our immunocompromised patients, and then our hematology patients, neutropenic enterocolitis can also be a mimicker. Less commonly, we may see malignant causes, such as small bowel lymphoma or adenocarcinoma. There are even more rare causes, a few of which I'll mention just because I think they're interesting. The more I learn about sarcoid, the less I understand it. And apparently sarcoidosis can also cause infiltration of the small bowel and can mimic a terminal ileitis, as can amyloidosis. And recently I learned of a new diagnosis called NSAID enteropathy, which is where NSAID ingestion can result in isolated terminal ileal ulceration.
In cases like this where we do see terminal ileitis, like on a CT scan, how do we differentiate between all these potential causes?
Great question, Casey. In most cases, you're going to want to evaluate for both infectious and inflammatory causes, since these are the most common. Workup includes sending infectious stool studies, such as a GI pathogen panel, testing for C. diff, serology allergies in select patients, those with immunocompromise or certain risk factors. And most patients are probably going to need to be evaluated endoscopically, most often with a colonoscopy with biopsy.
Can we go back to Yersinia?
I was hoping you'd ask. Yersinia is one of the many gram-negative bacteria that can cause gastrointestinal infections. Yersinia is able to adhere and invade the gut epithelial wall, where it tends to set up shop in lymphoid tissues, which is part of what can cause that pseudo-appendicitis picture. It's a zoonotic infection with a domestic reservoir primarily in pigs, which makes transmission largely foodborne via contaminated pork products. The most common presenting features of Yersinia infection are abdominal pain, which can localize to the right lower quadrant, again, that pseudo-appendicitis, diarrhea, fever, nausea, and vomiting. Understandably, these constellation of symptoms can be mistaken for acute appendicitis, and there are cases where it has led to appendectomy. A smaller percentage of patients may also have an accompanying pharyngitis, which would be a distinguishing feature, as there aren't many things you can think of that would cause an acute GI illness with a concomitant pharyngitis. Patients who have impaired immunity or iron overload states may present with septicemia and more severe clinical features. Post-infectious sequelae include erythema nodosum, particularly in patients in Northern Europe, and reactive arthritis in association with the HLA-B27 genotype.
In this case where we diagnosed Yersinia enterocolitica, what was the treatment?
Well, generally speaking, treatment for Yersinia enterocolitis is controversial. For mild disease, treatment does not seem to impact the clinical course, but it does decrease fecal shedding. In patients with severe disease or an immunocompromising condition, you could consider treating with an oral fluoroquinolone or Bactrim for a duration of about 5 days. In patients with those risk factors who are presenting with sepsis or more severe infection, a third generation cephalosporin such as ceftriaxone or a fluoroquinolone plus gentamicin is recommended for a longer duration, up to 3 weeks.
Blake, thank you for teaching us about dyshemoglobinemias. Definitely more than I ever thought that I would learn about that. And we'll look forward to seeing you out giving instructions on how to find COVID vaccines.
You can find me in the courtyard.
Stay tuned for our next episode.